This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter, at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
Keep my patch on. Godless engineer, whenever you're ready.
Are you ready, kids?
Aye, Captain.
I can't hear you. Are you ready?
Aye, Captain.
Aye, Captain.
Oh, who lives in a pineapple under the sea?
SpongeBob
SquarePants.
Absorbent and porous is absorbent yellow and porous is he. If nautical nonsense be something you wish,
do I keep saying SpongeBob SquarePants?
Yes. Then drop on the deck and flop like a fish.
SpongeBob SquarePants.
SpongeBob SquarePants. SpongeBob SquarePants. SpongeBob SquarePants.
Ahoy, Captain. Thanks.
Y'all have a fun show.
Go walk the plank. Excellent. Oh man. Oh well. It's number one. Let me just say, and I think I can speak on Steve's behalf. It is good to be back in our regular time slot and streaming live again. It just wasn't the same without having the interaction from you people. I'll probably regret saying that at some point. Say something stupid and then I'll get attacked. But for now, it is very good to have you all back. We love you both. Big thanks to all of you that took the time to tweet at the studio and at Fact UK and at YouTube. That was really cool of you guys. And it is very humbling when you have that many people willing to, you know, do that sort of thing for you. So big thank you to you guys. We are here and back because of you. So. And funny enough, I got a message today from somebody at YouTube over Facebook, and they said that they were listening to our show last night where I went through some emails that I got that were supposed to be from a management partner, but I think they're from a bot. And he was willing to reach out and say, I was listening to your show. Let me see if I can get this escalated. And we'd already had it taken care of by then. But big thank you to him for at least reaching out. So. Tomorrow is Casey. What is tomorrow?
Tomorrow is Wednesday,
right? And there's, I feel like we're themed up for some reason today.
Yeah. What other important day is it tomorrow?
Sorry. Tomorrow. Hold on. I have to get dressed. Hold on. Tomorrow is International Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Arr. just briefly, go ahead and introduce the two lovely people that we have with us, and then we're gonna break away for just a second to talk about a big announcement, and then we'll jump right into the pirates. But Casey, go ahead and let everybody know who we have joining us tonight.
Okay, so today we have Lawrence Yufa, who is with Milwaukee Atheists. So welcome, Lawrence. He is a pirate. I'm sorry, I have to take these off. He is a big fan of all things pirate. And so we have him. Oh, yeah. We also have Benerson Little, who is a like real life pirate historian. So we're really excited to have you here too.
Thank you.
He's probably like, what have I gotten myself into? What is this? What is this that I'm doing right now? but before we jump into that, I wanted to take some time out and talk about you, my dear KC, have some huge news for people who might not have heard. Do you want to show them, share them?
Yeah, Godless Engineer and I are getting married. I can't, yay!
it only took countless hints that we dropped. Actually, somebody should go back and count how many times that was referred to on this show, because I think that we played a big part in that decision. So.
I think the rest of the Milwaukee Atheist crew were dropping hints when they visited.
Yeah.
We've been to Milwaukee a few times, and people have been giving him shit about it for a while.
That's so exciting. Well, I hear that we were talking before the show, everybody, and they decided that they're going to have a ceremony at Dinosaur Adventureland, since it's right there in their home state. Kent Hovind will be presiding over it, and that's exciting.
We're not doing that.
You are. It'd be the greatest story ever. Well, congratulations.
Dinosaur Adventureland, Kyle.
Well, congrats to both of you.
Thank you.
Pirates. I know probably bare minimum. I'll say probably what the average person does, because you go by what you see in like movies and some of the stories that you hear when you're in school. But I'm sure that there are not only stereotypes, but countless other pieces of pirate history that people don't know. And Lawrence, why don't you tell me why you got into pirates the way that you did, and what you're doing with that? Because you're doing some pretty cool stuff with that.
Well, so it's kind of a weird story. I had never watched any of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies until like last year. And I really got into it when I initially started listening to Ailstorm, a pirate metal band, and I fucking love them. And I was like, I wonder
pirate metal.
What real pirates... Yeah, pirate metal. Yeah, I wonder what
really?
Real
That's
pirates
a thing.
Were like. And
interesting.
I just took a deep dive into this stuff. I got Colin Woodard's The Republic of Pirates. And that is a fantastic book. And it kind of just gave me this jumping off point. And I became so enthralled with the true history of pirates. I mean, I ended up watching the movies anyways, because I felt like I had to.
Yeah.
But I so enjoy the real life thing more. It's so much cooler. It's so much more interesting. Like, yeah, it's like gruesome and brutal at some points. And it's not really pretty, but it's so cool. It's so interesting.
Real quick, who's your favorite pirate?
Henry Avery.
Henry Avery
is
that.
A fucking badass. Yeah. I think I'm actually on a delay. It kind of sounds like that to me. But anyways, so I had a series on my channel, and I say had because I have currently like suspended it for now. It was called The Captain's Log, and it was the complete history of piracy. And I went like stage by stage from when it wasn't exactly piracy, but you could call it piracy, like with the sea peoples, the Lucans specifically. And I got like 8 episodes in. And then for the 9th episode, I needed to cover the Aetolian League. And the best source for the Aetolian League is like it's like a 400 page book, but it costs $150 minimum. And I was like, I cannot afford this. And the series wasn't getting a lot of traction anyways. So I was like, okay, until there's a real want for this series again, I'm just going to put on the back burner for now.
Yeah. It's a good thing you didn't turn to a different type of piracy to settle that issue with the book costing so much.
You know, I tried. It did not go over well.
So, Mr. Little, tell us, introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do and why you do it. What got you into pirates?
Oh, well, Betterson Little, I've written several books on the subject of piracy. It was entirely accidental. Mostly I was interested in writing fiction. I started doing that kind of post nonfiction. Mostly I saw a lot of films when I was a kid. As long as I can remember, I wanted to be a pirate, fence with swords. In, I guess, around 1967, while my father was overseas, height of the Vietnam War, we moved back to Alabama, South Alabama, where my family's from, and that was culture shock for me. Although my parents were from Alabama, I didn't grow up with, let's just say, 1960s Alabama mores, manners, and morals. So it was quite distressing for me in a lot of ways, very, very different atmosphere, very different world. And I had an aunt give me a copy of Treasure Island, and it was an annotated copy, and I devoured the book, but the annotations with hindsight were mostly incorrect, but it didn't matter at the time. I thought it was revealing the reality behind piracy and pirate myths, and I loved the story, and I'd run off of my grandparents' 40 acres and pretend it was Treasure Island and stay, you know, just basically kind of opt out of a lot of the local culture. From there on, over the years, I would run across old journals and things, start reading them. It was kind of a hobby. I read Captain Blood, I think, in junior high school. Really enjoyed that. Raphael Sabatini's novels. Finished college. Went into the Navy. Became a naval officer, Navy SEAL. And I started noticing a lot of similarities between what I had seen or read in a lot of these old journals about pirate tactics and privateer tactics and the things that we did. Because things really don't change over time. You know, the fundamentals pretty much remain the same when the environments are the same. So I'm trying to finish fiction. As you guys probably, I'm sure, aware, fiction is very difficult to sell. But I had all this information on pirate tactics, and so I wrote a proposal up, sold the book, and wrote a few more after that. My goal has always been to try to look at the legitimate history, at the truth, wherever it leads me. It's very easy in piracy, or probably any subject, to go into it with the sense of, you know, if you grew up on pirate movies, you want to prove that pirates were like what you saw in the movies. If, you know, if you're a hardcore capitalist, you want to prove that pirates were hardcore capitalists. If you're a Marxist, you want to prove that they were Marxists. And I've tried as best I can to avoid this. It's difficult because we all come with our own, you know, prejudices and suppositions and things, but as best I can, I've done it. I've even got about 20,000 word supplement I post online of corrections, errata, and new information on my first book, for example, just to try to keep, you know, venturing in that same direction and truth. And in some ways, the internet's made that a lot easier. What Lawrence was saying about $100-some-odd book, a lot of sources you can get now for free or much cheaper, but research is still difficult because of, you know, access. You know, if you can't get into university libraries, if you don't have a wad of cash to blow on resources, it can be very, very difficult to get these things done. And the internet has also made it difficult in a way, too, on research, because right now it's given a platform to basically every ignoramus in the world, too, who wants to, you know, amen, argue or spread information, false information out there and flood it with stereotypes. Okay. And after a while, you just don't have time to, you know, you can't spend an hour arguing with somebody who doesn't know what he's talking about. And so it's good and bad. So anyway, if I start digressing a whole lot, just let me.
Mr. Little, you can actually do that. You can spend an hour that they arguing with people that don't know what they're talking about. That's what we specialize in, usually on this show.
But you at least appear pretty much trying to. But you appear to at least be trying to, you know, get to the facts and the truth, and, you know, at least get something out there that's quasi legitimate, you know. And I'd say 50% is a pretty good goal these days. To, you know, if you can get 50, it's like I told Black Sails, I was there historical consultant. If, you know, 50% of what I, you know, factually told them ended up in the show, I was completely happy with that.
Absolutely. So when we're dealing with pirates, I'm going to throw some, I guess what we'll do is let me throw out some names of some pirates, and just so that, just because I'm curious and I want to see if the image that you get in our culture or society today matches the actual pirate, or even if they really existed at all. And then I guess we'll Lawrence or Mr. Little, you can kind of take us through a pirate history of sorts, and you know how pirates started, what happened to them, you know, why we still don't see them up and down the seas.
Well,
now,
as but, Lawrence knows right now, that would probably be about 50,000, well, what, half a million words to do a brief summary.
That is not.
I mean, he's nine episodes, and he didn't even get out of antiquity. I mean, it's a vast subject. It's difficult.
Well, I'm sure. And maybe this might be something that we do. And we do this often with, especially our history episodes. The first time that we ever had somebody come on to talk about ancient coins, he had an idea that he wanted to do for an episode. He had slides that he sent in, and we had all of it uploaded and ready to go. And it was supposed to be a one episode thing. We're getting ready to do episode 5 of it, of that one that started out with that first episode. So we do have a way of taking a subject and asking so many questions that it's, you know, it grows into something much larger. But you hear Blackbeard, Captain Cook, these names. Who were the real people, and are they anything like what they're painted in, whether it be movies or TV shows, that sort of thing?
Who do you want to start off on this?
Let's go with Blackbeard first.
No, I think meant which of us do you want to start with?
Yeah.
Oh, either one. Either one. Whichever one
you can go
wants to tackle that.
I'll add to whatever one.
So Blackbeard was a real person. Edward Teach, or Edward Thatch. But I think Woodard argued that it was Teach. So he was not all that different from how he's portrayed in movies, you know, minus all the mythical stuff. He was a legitimately scary dude. People would just give up all their stuff without, you know, him even having to do much, because it wasn't, apparently he had crazy eyes, if you guys know what that phenomenon is. People just looked at him and they were like, this guy is insane. He did this thing where he put like burning wicks in his hat, and it gave him the effect of having his beard lit on fire. So he had this ring of smoke around his head, which gave
That's
a
badass,
pretty cool,
actually.
It's a pretty cool, scary effect. And he really did have the big beard, maybe not as big as it was portrayed in Pirates of the Caribbean. But at least from, you know, the one drawing I can recall of him, it wasn't that big, and I don't know how accurate that necessarily was. But he was a legitimately scary dude, successful pirate. And his last stand, I think, is really interesting. Maybe we'll get into that later. But his recorded last words kind of resonate with me. Damnation, seize my soul if I give you quarter or take any from you. And for those that don't know, quarter just means mercy. And I think that's really fucking epic. And Captain Cook, I think there may have been, you know, some pirate named Cook. I don't recall. But I don't think that was anywhere near a real person.
Okay.
There were a couple more. Let me throw at you. There were a couple of minor buccaneers named Cook. But unless you're actually doing some detailed research, you're probably not going to run across them. They're not something that the average person reading a couple of pirate books would come across.
Cool. More before we jump into what makes a pirate a pirate. Captain Crunch. True or false?
Real. 100% real. Captain Crunch was there were many kings of pirates, but Captain Crunch was the emperor.
So I have scars on the roof of my mouth to prove it.
So here's the next question. What's everybody's favorite Captain Crunch cereal?
There's more than one.
Well, there's the yellow pellets.
Yeah, we had the yellow pellets in the 60s. That was it.
Yeah, and then there's Captain Crunch with berries, which is the yellow pellets with berries. Then there's Peanut Butter Crunch, which is like the balls that are peanut butter. Then there's Oops All Berries, which are all the berries.
You're breaking up really bad.
What?
Your mic's breaking up really bad.
Yeah, it's not really like a robot?
Yeah, it's you might have to drop out and come back in to fix that. So let's go to Lawrence or Mr. Little. Actually, we'll start with Mr. Little on this question. Where did the pirate, movement come from? Like, what did they spring from? What caused these men to spend all their time at sea raiding other ships and that sort of thing?
It depends on the period and who you're talking to and what researcher you're talking to. It's an old Greek historian a couple thousand years ago put it as a combination of need and greed, and it's pretty much like any other human endeavor. If there's an opportunity to take from someone else, they're going to do it. In the early days, piracy was probably indistinguishable from general warfare at sea. I suspect that it's been, more than 100,000 years. We have evidence that people were trading on the water by sea, and I suspect that piracy occurred along the same. It's need and greed pretty much sums it up, a combination.
Lawrence, anything you want to add on that?
That was pretty much it. It really depends on the time period. This is kind of my personal opinion on this, and scholars disagree on this, but when it comes to the sea peoples, for example, they were never referred to as pirates, and even the early pirates in antiquity, they weren't necessarily referred to as pirates. It was just a general term. In Greek, it's a listas, which just translates to like raiders. But then eventually they developed, I'm sorry if you hear my dog barking, it eventually developed into, piratas. But when it comes to their motivations, it all depends on the period. And I know that I think Klein argues that the sea peoples, caused the Bronze Age collapse, but I'm thinking they were like a symptom of it. So like, it makes sense to me that in an already collapsing world where there's a lot of terrible things like drought and war, people would resort to stealing things. And in some of these cases, it was just migration that people took as war. But that's just my own personal thing. I kind of got off on a tangent there.
That's okay. Mr. Riddle, did you want to tag in on that?
Yeah, piracy basically is just unlawful or illegitimate theft at sea. And in, back in antiquity and probably pre-antiquity, it was just, a method of warfare. As long as it was considered legitimate, it really wouldn't be considered piracy. And it's the same thing today. Privateering has been outlawed since the 19th century, but if you're stealing at sea on the open ocean today, it's still considered to be piracy. If you're a nation state that happens to be plundering or confiscating at sea, it may or may not be piracy. It's just simply a question. It's basically a fairly modern question of legitimacy, especially in the Golden Age, 17th, 18th century. Oh, go ahead.
You can finish. That's okay.
17th, 18th century, basically a pirate meant someone who lacked a lawful mission from, if you were European, from a civilized government. You could be a North African corsair, a Barbary corsair. You could be a Malayan corsair. Europeans might consider you to be pirates, although technically you were still legitimately privateers because you were commissioned by a lawful government. So basically, two ways to look at it. If from European status, if you have a lawful commission by a lawful government, you were not a pirate, you were a privateer. Or if you were from an uncivilized country, you were a pirate no matter what you did. I'm not speaking from my own personal point of view here. I'm just sure. repeating the way people used to think.
Lawrence, before we ask this question, did you want to add in something there a second ago?
Yeah, yeah. That it also, he kind of touched on it earlier, that it depends on who you're talking to, because if you have an English privateer stealing from a Spaniard, the Spaniard's going to think you're a pirate either way. It doesn't matter. To the victim, the distinction really is inconsequential.
Okay. When we talk about stereotypes, I guess let's dive into these, because when you think of a pirate, and like for Halloween, there are certain things that people go to, markers of a pirate. And I'm interested to learn where they came from. So I've got a list of what I think are the you know, the most obvious stereotypical pirate, I guess, markings would be. And number one, there's the Jolly Roger flag. Where did that stem from? Whichever
it's,
one of you want to.
It's a legitimate flag used by in the early 18th century, but I did a lot of extensive research on this last book that I wrote. We don't ultimately know the origin of skull and bones on a flag. It's been used for centuries before pirates, but they did what we think of as Blackbeard and his ilk. They did adopt that in the early 18th century. It's entirely possible they adopted it from North African corsairs who were known to use it. There were old military units prior to this that had used it. But what was unique about it is that it was a black flag. We actually have an account of buccaneers, French buccaneers in 1688 using a red flag of no quarter with the skull and bones on it. But the black flag was definitely a legitimate there's some debate on what the origins of Jolly Roger. It's not Jolly Rouge, as you know, some people say, meaning pretty red. There's actually no reference to that. That reference, I think, comes from Jolly Drapeau Rouge, a mid-19th century French communist flag, actually. That's another problem, and I'm sure Lawrence has run into this in his own research, is it's really hard to stomp down these stereotypes. It's sometimes almost impossible. You can write books on it, you can write articles on it, and people are still going to believe. You're still going to see books today talking about the Jolly Rouge, meaning the origin of the Jolly name Jolly Roger, and it has absolutely nothing to do with it. But you know, it's really hard to stomp down, tamp down on ignorance, and really, and especially when it's been appropriated by the culture.
Okay. Lawrence, do you want to add in anything on that?
Yeah, sure. I think it's just important to note that many different flags were called Jolly Roger, even ones that were totally different. So like the skull and bones that we normally associate with the Jolly Roger, it's important to separate the flag from what we call it. So we have Spriggs and Bellamy and plenty of other pirates calling their flag Jolly Roger, and they all had different flags. So it's it is a really hard thing to point out. I know that at least the earliest I can personally think of as when we're calling a flag Jolly Roger and we're referring to the skull and bones, the earliest one I can think of for that would be Bellamy, because he did have the skull and bones, and they called it Jolly Roger. That's the early, and that was in the early 18th century. So that's the earliest one I can think of. But it's important to make the distinction.
Excellent, KC. Do you have a pirate stereotype you want to throw out there and see if where it originated from?
Oh, can't. We do not hear her.
Yeah, you're. We can't hear you.
No audio. I was gonna mention this before, but you know who wrote a great book on pirate myths? Benerson Little here. You should go pick up his book.
Oh, sweet. Excellent. We will get into that. Absolutely. Casey, can you give us a test real quick? Still not working.
Mm-mm. I see lips moving.
You might have to drop.
No sound.
Yeah. You might have to drop out and come back in and see if that fixes it, Casey. While we try to get that straightened out, the next one that I have written down is walking the plank. Did pirates really make people walk off the end of a board into a shark-infested ocean?
Spanish and South American privateers, who were basically pirates, did in the early 19th century during the Spanish Wars of Liberation. Prior to that, I'm not sure there's a mention of it, not in regard to piracy, in the late 18th century. It seems to have been picked up in the early 19th century by a British adventurer who wrote about the Spanish Wars of Independence, and he described it in detail, literally putting a plank out and pushing these people overboard. These were very brutal wars. And it seems like every pirate author after that kind of picked it up and ran with it. You don't need to put on a plank out to throw people overboard. People have been thrown overboard for thousands of years, but these people seem to sort of make a fetish out of it, I guess.
I think it makes it more eerie.
Keel hauling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, there we go.
Yes, we can.
Okay.
Okay, good. Sorry. Now you're back. Hi. Is the sound okay? No longer robot?
No, you're fine now.
Sounds fine.
Okay.
You're fine now. Right. We were talking about walking off the plank and how that originated. And after, we'll let Lawrence add in on if he has anything, and then we'll go to you and you can throw out your list of stereotypes. So, Lawrence, anything you want to add in on that?
I think the only thing I would add in on that, and I think I may have actually gotten this from Benerson's book, then you can tell me if there's been some new research on this, that sometimes they would do it as like a test for a captain. Like they would blindfold you, get you drunk, and then you would have to walk on the board. And if you didn't fall off, great. Or maybe if it was just for the crew, not for the captain. But I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's a reference. I think it's a 19th century reference, and it's called Walking the Plank. Basically, see, it's essentially a sobriety test, but they took its name, Walking the Plank, from the idea of actually walking a plank overboard. But essentially, I'm not sure. It would be interesting to know if they actually used it as a test for sobriety for a watchstander. Okay, I guess if you could walk the straight line, you were sober enough. I'm speculating here, sober enough to actually stand watch. But if you couldn't, probably could get busted.
I am not good to be a pirate. I'm figuring that out now. I would never last out to sea. Not a chance. Casey, do you want
to? And just a sure. Quick hop in. If we need it, because tomorrow is Talk Like a Pirate Day. So I brought two books that we might need for this, or if you guys want me to pull something up here. I have E.T. Fox's Pirates in Their Own Words, and it's just a collection of documents, pretty much. And then I have something that's kind of more fun. Not all of it is necessarily true. It's just more fun. The Pirate Primer, Mastering the Language of... I can't talk right now. Mastering the Language of Swashbucklers and Rogues by George... I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Choundis? No, I don't know. But that was just good. More, a bit more fun.
That's as good a guess as mine.
What is the primer about?
It's basically just like a dictionary for pirate language, and it gives you like these... it gives you like pronunciations too. Like I can pull one up. Let's see, under commands, belay that, and it's supposed to be pronounced belay thart, And it means stop that talk, shut up, be quiet. And this is a reference. I don't know if this is real or fake, because this guy uses some fictional things to make this. But he also took from real sources as well. It looks like it's there's a reference to it in Treasure Island, and then Blackbeard's ghost. That also sounds fake. So just taking a
that's maritime terminology. It's used. You even hear that term in modern Navy still at times. And one thing to remember is a lot of what's ascribed to pirates is their language. It's actually not pirate language. It's maritime language. It's, you know, I've had people come to me and say keel hauling is a pirate tradition. Pirates didn't keel haul. Dutch Navy and later the French and some of the other Scandinavian navies keel hauled. It's really a naval tradition. Same thing with a great deal of the language that you see. Pirates, anything that what particularly distinguishes pirate language is probably an excess of foul language, even greater than the average sailor, which is a hell of a lot if you think about it, because very few sailors even today I've known that don't cuss a lot. You know, I'm trying to, you know, stifle mine right now with a toddler running around so that he doesn't pick it all up, because they pick up everything. So, and I haven't been in the Navy since 89.
I thought you were going to say you were trying to keep it down because of us, and I was going to introduce you to Casey again, because he is the master of...
Well, the funny thing was, I was...
I come by it honestly.
I was out in L.A. working with Black Sails, the writer's room, one of the times I was out there, and one of the co-creators of the show was just very, very polite, and he would apologize when he cussed until somebody finally looked at this guy and said, this guy was a naval officer, Navy SEAL. He says, you can probably say anything you want in front of him. I was the one trying to be polite, you know, but I just thought it strange that somebody was trying to, you know, clean their language up in front of me. So I'm working hard on keeping mine clean right now, because it's
that kid's picking everything up. Everything. So. They repeat everything.
Good luck.
Everything.
And they naturally, I have two grown daughters too, so I've been through this before, but forgot it all. But they understand, I know we're off subject of piracy temporarily, but they also understand the situation of the circumstance. So if I just said, for example, shit, just casually, he'd probably ignore it, you know. But if I drop something on my foot and just spew, he knows that's important and that's the proper time to say it. And he's going to repeat it in the proper circumstance. And then if you tell him not to repeat it, he's going to repeat it 12 times.
Yeah.
Yep. You'd be a good sailor.
That's a very good point. Why do we jump to like a cuss word? Why do we jump to that when either we get injured or we're pissed off? Like, what is it about the word that makes us temporarily feel better, or that's the choice word that we go to? That's a deep question.
I don't know. One of my books, I put about 500 words in a pirate book talking about their language, and I actually wrote a 500-word mini essay on the defense of cussing, and I don't even remember what I wrote now, but it keeps me sane, I think.
Yeah.
I've heard people say that it actually escalates. I've heard people say it escalates violence. That has the opposite effect in me. If I can actually vent by cussing, I'm less likely to do anything stupid, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it makes me feel so much better.
What gets me is the people that have a problem with cussing. Because if you think about it, we as people, we create sounds with our, you know, our vocal cords, and they're just noises. Like, why do people put such an emphasis on, you know, damn, shit, or a thing like that? Like, why do they let a word influence them in such a way? I've never understood that. I've never understood why people deem some words to be a curse word and some words to be okay. And nobody can explain that.
I think Vsauce actually has an amazing video on that called I think it's just called "Why Are Bad Words Bad," and he kind of breaks it down into classes, basically. Like the elite would use certain words, and then the peasants would use certain words, and some of the words that the peasants used became curse words. That's like the gist of it.
It's very interesting. where were we? We did get off on a tangent there. KC, your stereotype.
Well, so I have a stereotype, but then I have a couple of other questions too, if y'all don't mind. So my stereotype is parlay. Like, was parlay really a thing? Or is parlay a thing?
I may have read something about, what, 19th century mountain men using it. Mostly I'd heard it show up in the Old West. I don't recall seeing it in any original journals or anything about even anybody at sea or pirates saying, hey, let's have a parley. I guess you might see it somewhere in the sense of, again, this is something that has crept right into our culture based on a film. Maybe Lawrence has run across something that I haven't seen on that.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you. I haven't seen a single thing about it in any of the old stuff I've read, like any of the original documents or in any contemporary book. I haven't seen a single thing about parlay. Well, that doesn't mean it wasn't real, but I just...
I'm pretty sure I probably saw it in Daniel Boone or, you know, Davy Crockett or something on TV growing up as a kid, or, you know, some movie about mountain men or something, or, you know, maybe in one of my uncle's old Louis L'Amour paperbacks or something. But
okay. So before he left, Godless Engineer had a couple of questions, so I'm going to go ahead. Was there a code of ethics for pirates?
I'm sure both of us can answer this. Did you want to kick it off?
It doesn't matter. There was a code of ethics. First, anybody going to sea with a privateer piracy would basically have the ship's articles, which are essentially the articles, the laws governing behavior. But as Lawrence knows well, late 17th, early 18th century, there was sort of a code of conduct among the brethren. It could be modified by individual crews. It wasn't absolute laws, but it was a fairly definitive set of expectations, I think.
Yeah, they were generally the same. The only like real difference that I can think of is Cheng Yi Cao's code. It specifically had rules because usually the any of the pirate codes that we, and I'm just going to say it that because it's more colloquial pirate code. I'm sorry if you hear the grandfather clock in the back. Usually they had rules against murdering your captives, but Cheng Yi Cao's rules also had a rule against raping the captives. So that's probably the most significant divergence I can think of, but as he said, they had different rules depending on who's your captain.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I suspect Cheng Yi Cao's rule against rape was primarily to keep discipline or more on the crew, because they were allowed to marry. You know, basically, if you wanted the woman, you had to marry her, which sounds nice, but it's you know, forced marriages. I think it's legitimized rape, basically, but it's still rape. But again, I think this was probably a disciplinary. You know, let's not let the crew go rampant. Let's actually, you know, try to get them to marry these women and bring them into the crew. And the women didn't have a whole lot of say in it, I don't think.
So, were there typically women on pirate crews?
The Chinese, yes. The Chinese were probably the only ones I can think of that actually had a fairly systematic or large number of women aboard their crews. They basically were these pirate junks, literally hundreds and hundreds of them, were basically floating homes for families and everything. But other than that, like Lawrence says, no, you can't. It's very, very rare. There are a few notable exceptions. During the Golden Age, there's basically Anne Bonny and Mary Read, and their deeds have actually been overemphasized. When their piracies were actually a very small time. I would, however, say that based on a number of there were a number of women caught pretending to be men at sea during this era. So I would not be surprised if there weren't some women pirates who just went undiscovered. They would probably have gone to sea as men and just never discovered. And that would be fascinating to find some good information on that. But I haven't come across. And a lot of the women who are named during this period as pirates either were not pirates or didn't exist. I mean, you can't go up to a popular website that lists women pirates because you can start striking, you know, every other one probably off the list. I understand the need to want to identify women pirates, and I actually believe that there were probably quite a few that we don't know about. But unfortunately, there's been some bad scholarship in a lot of ways. I'll try to think of her name, Charcot de la Haye, or however you want to call her. I still argue with people today. She was created by a French writer in the 1940s, but you'll find her listed in books and websites as this, you know, 1650s female pirate on Tortuga. You know,
interesting.
And this being the internet age, people will not take your word for it. You say, well, show me the documentation. Well, it's on the internet. It must be true.
Must be.
Yeah. Before the Golden Age, there were just like a couple that I can think of. There was Grace O'Malley, and there was in antiquity, and I don't know how to actually pronounce her name. It was a queen, Tuta or something like that. I think her husband was a pirate, and then he died, and then she kind of took over everything. And then Polybius basically just said what boils down to the modern equivalent of "that bitch was always on the rag."
Okay.
Oh, well, he didn't hold back.
That's what Polybius said about her. Yeah, that's what Polybius said.
Awesome.
But yeah, she was fairly successful.
Okay, so like when pirates would be out on the sea, did they just like pillage anything they came across, like all the ships, or did they have like specific people they wouldn't go after, or how that work?
This kind of gets into the area of are they privateers or legitimate pirates? You have buccaneers, late 17th century, were kind of quasi pirates. So often they didn't have lawful commissions. They kind of had a wink and a nod. And they were mostly going after the Spanish, although occasionally they might, you know, take a Dutch or a Portuguese ship, which was, strictly speaking, piracy. It also need to probably move away from the notion that pirates just kind of roamed the ocean blue looking for prey. They basically stayed in the channels where they knew there would be trade along coastlines. They were good at collecting intelligence, and the idea was to intimidate your prey into surrender without a fight, plunder it. And again, as Lawrence knows well, he could run a long, long series on this, even in just the Golden Age from, let's say, 1655 to 1725 or 30. I mean, you could do 50 episodes, and over that time, just see the gradual changes, you know, in types of piracy tactics. They're all small, subtle divisions, but from the beginning to the end of that, you can actually see a cultural shift just over that 50, 60, 75 years.
Did they fight like countries' navies also? Or
that's kind of a myth that's grown. Generally, they wanted to avoid men of war. Late 17th century, you would find some buccaneers, or French filibusters, same thing, basically, engaging Spanish men of war. And you did find some English. England had a strong navy back then that were, sorry, I'm dealing with a cat over here, a 16-pound cat. And the English were concerned about their strength. They had late 17th century, these buccaneers were very, they had quite a bit of military prowess. A lot of them had been former soldiers. They'd grown up in a military kind of an atmosphere. They were considered themselves quasi sea and land warriors. They would attack and sack towns and cities as well as take prey at sea. But by the early 18th century, you're pretty much seeing privateers who are basically seamen alone and not attacking anybody ashore anymore. And by the early 18th century, and I hate saying it, as much as we glorify Blackbeard and all these guys pretty much ran from men of war because they were I have documented this well, and I've had readers who just refuse to believe it. It's like you've crushed their heroes or something, but I know Blackbeard had a glorious end, but basically he fired a couple broadsides at some English naval volunteers who were coming after him in small local sloops with no protection, and he ran, and he fought basically because he had to. Bartholomew Roberts, that everybody holds up to be one of the greatest pirates of the era, his consort ran when confronted by an English man of war, and that man of war just, took the guy down very quickly. Same thing happened to Roberts. And part of that is because professional navies were designed to close with an enemy and kill them. But by the early 18th century, pirates were basically out there. They're like, I compare a lot of the 18th century pirates to Somali pirates. Go out and intimidate merchantmen, steal and rob their cargoes, and run like hell for men of war, because the professionals are probably going to kill you.
Yeah.
It turned out that bad every time. Somali pirates. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, with the Somali thing, I have that written down because when you think, when you say pirate, I think people get kind of like what you were alluding to. There's a grandiose sense of, I don't want to say hero, but it's almost like an admiration for what a pirate was, with us looking back. Like, that's really cool. Even though what they were doing is effectively the same as what we deal with today with Somali pirates. But you wouldn't hear anybody, I don't think, say, all the Somali pirates, that's really cool. You know what I mean? They have parallel reasons for why they do what they do. But what separates them mm-hmm. apart, or why does one get, you feel differently about one group and not the other?
It's cultural, basically. And there may be a certain racial aspect to it as well. I think Lawrence touched on this well earlier, and this is something I wrote a book, Pirate Hunting, that is really written from the point of view of pirate hunters and their victims. It's history of piracy from that point of view. And Lawrence touched on it earlier when he said that for the victim, it doesn't matter. We glorify pirates today, but if you read some of the Spanish records, accounts of victims of the sack of Veracruz, from the buccaneer side, it looks like this glorious episode of, buccaneering. Disney has an entire ride devoted to it. That is, ignore the movies. That ride is originally basically buccaneers sacking a Spanish town. They are torturing people. I love the ride, but, I put it in a proper cultural context. But when you read the Spanish accounts of what was going on during this, you really want to side with the Spaniards. And I know, Spain did a lot of things that are, they brutalized the New World, and then they were being brutalized. But, it's hard to defend rape and, children stuffed into a church and starving to death and, all kinds of things like that. So anyway, going back to your question, Lawrence, I'm sure has a good perspective on this as well. It may be different. It's really cultural. Nobody wants to look at Somali pirates. Oh, that's a bunch of those Africans with guns, thugs, which, you could apply that same definition to the early 18th century pirates, or probably just about any, thugs with guns. As far as the romantic aspect, I'm more inclined to prefer the buccaneers, because at least often the people they were attacking had pretty stout defenses, were willing to attempt to defend, but if you're a pirate, you're running around and your only prey is like the Somalis, you're going to go point guns at people who don't have guns. And you will notice, by the way, that as soon as merchantmen started arming, Somali pirates never took an armed ship.
Yep. That makes sense.
I personally haven't done a lot of research on Somali pirates. I have a book on it, but I haven't gotten to it yet. But I, at least from my point of view, I especially like the tactics, like the mindset of not modern pirates, but all other pirates. I like, while yes, what they were doing was terrible, absolutely, I think that there's a certain cleverness in like the way they did things that I think is really interesting. And I'm not sure if that exists currently with Somali pirates.
I think it has a lot to do with the time period. You know, like we tend to romanticize that time period. You know, the Victorian, Elizabethan eras, everything about those we romanticize and in every way. And I think that when you look at those big magnificent ships they would build, the large sails, the elaborate outfits, there's just something about that I think that is missing. Now, if the Somalis went and built a large wooden ship and put on velvet robes and walked around with a hook on their hand, I think we could regain the traction for pirates again. I believe we could bring make pirates great again. Okay, so that brings me to what I had on my list next, which was those three things: the peg leg, the eye patch, and the hook. Why are those things associated with pirates? Was there actually pirates that walked around with peg legs and hooks for hands?
A few, maybe, but you can't do a lot. There's Johnson references one, but basically, it's if you got your legs shot off, you ended up with a seaman were commonly discharged with wooden legs. You know, this you could become a cook. You might be some kind of a sea artist, but there's not a lot you can do once you lose your leg. Basically, made you a cripple, as they would have termed it back then. But it looks good for Hollywood. Hollywood has seized on these things. If you want to really see a good origin of a lot of these modern myths, go look at Douglas Fairbanks and the Black Pirate. It's a great film. It's beautifully shot, laid at the scenes look almost like paintings, but it's, you know, it's probably got most of the stereotypes. Eye patches. There were eye patches too, but that's meant that you lost an eye. It wasn't anything having to do with piracy. It was just you lost an eye in battle or from disease. You know, civilians wore them. You know, gentlemen wore them. You know, common workers wore them. It was, again, this goes back to a whole lot of our ideas of piracy are really maritime or just, you know, have been generically ascribed. They look cool. They're a way to distinguish and create a caricature, basically. I don't remember who wrote that, but somebody, and maybe Lawrence can recall who wrote it, but it pointed out that it's our modern idea of the pirates is basically a caricature, and we've sanitized them so much it made them almost childlike, so they're not frightening anymore. You know, they're things you tell kids about.
I think I actually do remember who wrote that. It was in the book X Marks the Spot. It's about the archaeology of piracy, and it was in the introduction book. Actually. Yeah, it was, I think it was Sherwood was the author. Yeah. I think it was in there. I remember.
Oh, I have it. Yeah. I'm about 50 feet from my library, so I'm not getting up, but it's a very good book.
I was actually
oriented too.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, that's okay. I was just saying that it's don't forget what you're going to say. I'll take 30 seconds on this. You can basically break down research is probably in any field into two sorts. There are those who are strictly fact oriented, and then there are the ideologues. You know, and I'm not saying ideologues can't do good work, but they always tend to be biased toward their ideology. And that could be a Marxist or a capitalist or a, you know, pirates were just really cool, awesome dudes, you know, whatever that ideology is. But X Marks the Spot is excellent because, you know, archaeologists, cartographers there's some cartographers who've written some excellent.
Did we lose him?
Did he walk the plank?
I thought you lost me for a second.
Oh, no, he walked the plank.
I just had to pop back in. He probably, might have lost his signal. He can use that same link to come back in.
And did you hear any of that?
I'll let him
there he is.
Oh, he's back.
Did you hear the screen locked up? And it's been doing that occasionally. So I don't know how much of that you heard and how much you didn't hear.
We got about half of it.
About half of it. Anyway, real simple. People who have to deal primarily with facts, like cartographers and such, they tend to write very good, rigorous works on piracy because, you know, they want names, dates, places, and proof. And ideologues tend to be a little bit softer when it comes to proof, whatever basically they can cherry pick to fit theirs. And I'm not completely picking it. There's some very good work out there across the spectrum on piracy, but, you know, it's always read the footnotes, always read the endnotes, because you'd be amazed how many times, especially in an ideologue's book, how many times there's actually no support for what they're claiming. They put an endnote, you know, and so everybody assumes, oh, they got to support it and document it. And then you find out it has absolutely nothing to do with. But there's a footnote there. So anyway, my micro rant.
We know all about that, actually. Yeah, I think
people,
the sources.
People do that a lot with Avery, and you know, they use Daniel Defoe's book. And I'm like, I'm not sure that's a historical document. And like people would like cite it. So that's always a bummer. Whenever I'm looking up anything about Avery, I'm making sure it's not from Defoe.
Yeah, the fictionalized account. Yeah, it's like I said, we said, I don't know how to fix the problem. You can write books on the subject. You can write blog posts. You can go on shows and tell people this, and they still end up believing. I mean, just look at politics right now. You know, it's, you can pile facts on top of people. And they're
a lot of categories, actually.
Yeah, they're
you'd be surprised
Yeah. Well, we've all been there, you know, even growing up, we've had, you don't need to go out with that person. They're an asshole, and you do anyway. But over time, in theory, you start learning and, you know, getting smarter. But, you know,
there's a nice thing about this, you look back. Facts.
The saving grace is that if you look through history, it goes up and down. And I suspect that even what we're going through now, you know, locally, nationally, there'll be a backlash to it, and things will sort out until a generation later people forget about it, and, you know, we screw it all up again.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's what we go through cycles. I think that's a good, that's a very good point. We're going through a really bad one now with this whole flat earth thing, but I do have a question pertaining to that here in just a second. But Casey, you want to go ahead and ask what you were going to ask a second ago? Excuse me.
I wasn't going to ask anything. I was just going to, they were talking about eye patches. So I was going to tell my eye patch story, like, cause they were talking about people wearing eye patches. And so that's all. I used to wear an eye patch. I was born blind in one eye and the doctors fixed it with eye patches. So like I used to wear an
eye patch
when I was little. It wasn't when you're a little kid and people pick on you, but my mom did a really cool thing. I was telling Kyle and Dave, she would get the adhesive, like Band-Aid kinds, and she would draw stuff on the patch. And so like kids at school would want to know, hey, what's on your eye patch today? So like it wasn't so bad, but yeah.
So I would have thought that was cool.
A faux pirate.
Faux piracy.
I will say one thing real quick.
Sure.
And this may have come up during, probably started by the Mythbusters episode, and then some doctor wrote an article on it. If you see a pirate or anybody at sea wearing an eye patch, it was because they lost an eye, like I said earlier, not because it made them see better, or because I've had somebody ask me that, oh, it's because they could see better when they fought under decks. And I said they didn't fight under decks. They chopped holes in the deck and threw explosives down there to flush everybody out. All you have to do is put it on some silly ass popular show and everybody will believe it. You know, I had one of the directors on Black Sails want to do an opening shot about bouncing a cannonball, a round shot, you know, off the water because they'd seen it on a show. And it's like, no, it didn't happen. It's called a drown shot because it goes in the water and it stays there. You know, it's, you know, but that.
Yeah, cannonballs don't bounce.
You can skip them across flat water in a harbor. What this came from was a late 16th century book that said that if you're going to make a mistake in aiming, it's better to make a mistake aiming low than high because the shot might bounce off the water and hit the hull. Okay, might. But most of the time, it's not going to do that. And you can skip them across in harbors, but, you know, somebody misreads this, they're going to test it, try to prove it, and then you got a director seeing it, and then you have people asking you questions about, you ever tried to skip a rock and, you know, the surf, it doesn't really skip it. You know, it's,
yes. And I never could do it. And I always, my brother could skip them perfectly, but I never could get one of them still to this day. I tried a year
Yeah, in flat water, but you know, go down to San Diego when the surf's up and try skipping. You know, it's not going to skip. And it's pretty much going to sink. You know, you need a nice flat.
You said something a minute ago. Interesting, like though. When you talk about the eye patch, number one, I don't see why anybody would think that one less eye is better than two. So I agree with you wholeheartedly on that. Two eyes is always better, but you said that they would carve out holes in the wall and throw explosives down to get them out. That doesn't seem like a good option on a boat.
Well, it's what you have is we have a misconception of how boarding actions were fought. Naval actions sometimes were fought with crews on the deck, and where one crew would try to resist the other. But for most merchant ships and also small naval vessels attacked by a much larger one, they would retreat to something that's called closed quarters. They would barricade themselves behind the bulkheads at the forecastle or the quarter deck, and these could be very, very intricate. They're very, you know, they were reinforced. They had loopholes. They had small ports where you could take the cannon and turn them in line with the ship and fire into the borders. So basically, and John Smith of Pocahontas fame, Jamestown fame, basically said that was the worst sort of fighting in the world, worse even than trenches on land. You know, you're on a rolling ship, you boarded her, and your enemy is completely barricaded, and they're turning the waist of that ship into a kill zone. So how do you flush these people out? You try to suppress their fire. It's very modern. You know, militaries do the same thing today. And you've got boarding axes, and that, by the way, is where the name the boarding axe comes from. It's because it was used to chop holes. You take those in crowbars, and you try to pry up planks, and then you start launching smoke bombs, grenades, anything else you can, because people can't breathe. You know, those things produce a lot of smoke, and people can't breathe. You choke them and flush them out. And this is really how a lot of boarding actions were fought, and they would go on for hours sometime. There are accounts of ships literally fighting, trying to breach these closed quarters as fortification for hours. Black Sails, season one, the opening episode, they kind of alluded to this. You know, I'm a historical consultant saying, well, this is how you do it. You need to be chopping this. So, you know, instead the captain and his crew get behind closed quarters and the pirates roll a barrel and the bulkhead blows up and, you know, much more effective in Hollywood. So it's, like I said, that 50% rule I was talking about, you know, that was half correct. So better than nothing.
You mentioned Pocahontas. Now I have Colors of the Wind stuck in my head. So
sorry about that. Yeah, my oldest daughter.
That's okay. I love
it. Her mid-20s now. I remember her Pocahontas shoes. That movie came out.
You can tell obviously that I'm gay because I love musicals, and anytime somebody mentions a musical, I instantly get whatever the song is from that stuck in my head, and I can't get it out. So it's pleasant.
I couldn't tell. I have no instinct, natural judgments for people's sexuality. It's one of those areas I taste totally. You know, it's whatever. You know, it's
Skadar is off.
Yeah,
yeah. Sorry about that. I mean, I used to love watching Camelot. You know, and I could think of it. I've actually seen several. Back in the 80s, I guess, the revivals of a whole bunch of, I saw Richard Burton and Richard Harris in Camelot on stage. Richard Burton looked drunk. Richard Harris was good. But, you know, a lot of those back then, so.
Excellent.
My favorite musical is The Producers. I love The Producers. Yes.
That's a good one.
That's a good one, too. Anything Goes is mine. Which... ironically, it was on a boat. It was it takes place on a boat, so that's very fitting. Where was I? I got musicals now stuck in my head. I'm off my tangent.
Maybe this will help. Want to add in a note on peg legs and eye patches and stuff. When it comes to pirates. When they were doing, you know, some raid, when they were, you know, taking a ship, or, you know, whatever they were doing, if you lost, you know, like a limb, or if you lost something while this was going on, there would generally be some reimbursement. So if you actually, you know, successfully pull this stuff off, then you get, you know, the booty, and that is the technical term, by the way, booty. So you get that stuff.
I was waiting. I've been waiting this whole time to make that joke.
So you get that stuff first, and then before you distribute it in normal shares, you would give the person who lost a limb some reimbursement depending on what they lost.
Well, still though, I don't know if there's, I don't know if there's an amount of money that I would be okay with for losing a body part. I guess if you have to, you know, if you lose it, it's better than nothing, but I don't know how I would equate that or justify that.
Yeah, a lot of merchant seamen didn't have that. If it wasn't written into their articles, you know, they literally knew, and that's why they often wouldn't fight. If they lost a limb, which was quite possible in action, they were cripples, basically. If you go do go to the Rijksmuseum, they have an incredible digital collection, extremely high res, and also they removed any copyright restrictions. You could use it for just giving them a plug, any commercial or personal purposes, whatever I want. But if you start looking through there for you can look for wooden legs or just look, almost every illustration is of a beggar, basically, because these, you know, once you lost a limb, you couldn't work anymore. We have quotes from seamen who basically have said, I'm not going to fight because I'll be a beggar if I lose my arm or my leg. I can't do anything anymore.
Did lots of them get scurvy?
I don't know that too many pirates got scurvy because they ate pretty well. They never really were out at sea for long voyages. That really has to do more with, you know, being way out at sea and long voyages. Plus, pirates tended to suck down rum punch anyway, and that's basically rum and key limes and sugar. So, you know, you're not going to get sugar sucking that stuff down, which is a good punch too, by the way.
Yeah.
Is it vitamin C deficiency? Gums rotten, teeth fall out, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
The last question that I had before we'll open it up to is the live chat. Is it true that there were some ships that got attacked? I know that whales was a real thing, but giant squid, I've always wondered if that was true. If there were really squid so big that they would take on a ship. Is that just fiction or is that a real thing?
Well, I know that giant squids are real, but I don't recall any attacks from them.
Yeah. If you've seen them washed up on beaches when they pulled even a giant squid, you know, that's a pretty, you know, limp invertebrate. You know, I don't imagine it's going to haul much of anything down. I'd say it's, you know, I suppose some of the giant octopus could drown a swimmer.
So disappointing.
So speaking of like giant things attacking ships, have you guys seen the Meg?
No, I haven't.
I want to so bad.
It's good. It's pretty good. I mean, it's a big fucking shark.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to ask this question because we'll get too many people pissed off because of the spoiler alerts. But text me after wherever because I have a question about the movie that I'm dying. Like, I can't wait until I see it in the theaters. I need an answer right now. Now that I know that you've seen it.
It's probably going to be out of theaters soon. So you should probably
get to see it. It has been out for a while.
Yeah.
I need a life outside of YouTube.
Yes, I have to admit. I feel that going on vacation and getting away from like YouTube and shit for like 5 days was really nice. It's really nice.
Yeah, I think it was with that whole battle thing that we've been dealing with for the past 4 days. It's just like mentally draining, you know. I still feel off, even though last night when I got the notification that it had been removed, it was like a 1,000 pounds lifted up off your shoulders. But then you get like the just draining. But giant squid. I'm kind of sad that that's not true because I had it in my head that these things would literally shoot up, wrap around the mast, like pull it down to the side, and then reach another tentacle in and wrap up the captain and pull him in. I mean, come on.
It was always the captain.
The cool thing is going to be when they get footage of sperm whales actually eating these things, because they live off these things, apparently. And that's one day they'll get footage of that. That'll be cool. You know, I don't think it's going to be the epic underwater battles. You know, I had a book when I was a kid that showed, you know, the giant squid and the sperm whale locked in Mortal Kombat. It's probably not that. They probably just crunch these things. But It'll be cool.
Yeah.
Yep.
Somebody finally gets something like that.
The ocean frightens me in so many ways. Like it, when I stop and think about it, it literally terrifies me because man and women have explored 5 to 10% of the ocean, meaning that 90% of it is a question mark. It's unknown. We think that the Marianas Trench is the deepest point in the ocean, but we don't know because we've only explored that 5 to 10%. So what else is in there? And I can't think of anything more terrifying than to be shipwrecked in the middle of the ocean, thousands of miles away from land at nighttime in the dark. Like, to me, that is the ultimate form of terror.
The sea's pretty at night.
Oh, no.
It could settle your nerves.
It's a silver lining right there.
You want to go on our cruise with us,
canopy of stars.
I could do a cruise because, well, I don't know. I don't know if I could. Like, I won't even go into sensory deprivation chambers for this reason. I got offered to go
either.
Into one, but...
I
but there's something
either.
About like you have this giant, vast void underneath you, and you cannot see anything that's coming at you. Like you don't know what's going to be up under you. Not in this, obviously, guys. Not in the sensory deprivation chamber. I know that's only 10 inches of water, but your mind plays tricks on you. And so, the way that my mind would work is I would be in that chamber, floating. And so my mind's going to start racing and working, and I'm going to start thinking of Casey going to see the Meg. And then all of a sudden there's going to be a school bus size shark underneath my ass in a metal tank. And I'm going to panic and freak out and probably get injured. So I can't do that.
Just punch it right in the face.
Bigger than
it's
okay. I have a pirate related question from the chat. Andrew Kroll, what is Davy Jones' locker?
It was kind of like
a Beatles song.
I think there. I think that there was, you know, actually a pirate named like David Jones. I don't know much about that one, about the pirate, but it was kind of like it's kind of like pirate hell, I guess. It was kind of like a myth. I don't know why it was started, but it was it's just like this cultural thing, and I think it only existed like, I think it was just after the Golden Age, actually. It might have been during the Golden Age.
Yeah, I think I've seen some 17th century references. Basically, if you're a bad sailor and you die at sea, you're, you know, hell's at sea, you know.
Gotcha.
This is a step up if you're going to go to hell. Yeah, at nighttime. I'm serious. You need to check the sea out at night.
I will from a land mass. I will be with my feet on
the
ground. I will gladly look at the sea at nighttime. Absolutely, no trouble. On a pier. Just as a side note, and then Casey, if there's any questions that you see, you can ask them, and then we're. Go to Dave for super chats. I'm on my iPad right now, so I can't actually see your questions, guys. Hey, Kitty.
Anybody before you start, anybody who has questions, tag me.
I'm trying to think of a really creative cat pirate name, but I'm coming up.
Speaking of cats,
Admiral Meow.
Here, come on, buddy. He's a 16-pound stray we picked up a few years, and
Commodore
he'd actually been in a fight, and he'd actually been in a fight and had an abscess in his head, and the fuzziest Lord. Balls he's ever seen.
And then Lawrence has a black beard, black fur.
my cat's actually part bobcat, like a quarter bobcat, so he's a vicious little fucker. I love him.
That's not terrifying.
Kyle, he says, S.O. Lycan in the chat says Captain Kibble.
Oh, that's good.
For a cat name, Captain Kibble. Yeah.
You win. You win.
All right. Go ahead, Casey. Oh, you do your thing, and then I have a question. Well, I mean, there's a question.
I was just going to tell a really quick why I'm scared of the ocean like that. There was a guy in town here when I was in high school. He went – they were actually just fishing, and it was him and a friend of his, and they were I forget if it was like – it was a couple hundred feet away from the pier, but they had tied off to the pier, and the rope broke, and so they started – drifting, and they were like, well, we'll be okay because the current's not too bad. But before they knew it, they had been swept out, and they weren't found for 28 days. 28 days. And he said that it was not only the creepiest, I forget how he worded it, but he said it was terrifying to be in the middle of the night, especially when the clouds were over the moon. So there wasn't any of that light reflecting off the water, to be out into a just black void of nothingness. You know, it's just you and the rocking boat with no moonlight, no nothing. And that just, I guess when I was in high school, it just stuck with me. And so ever since then, you will not find me in any water at nighttime. No way. Unless it's a hot tub. I'll do a hot tub.
Yeah. Okay. So I have a couple of questions. Dan the Machine asked, were captains elected?
At least during some part of the Golden Age, yes. I'm not sure how it worked in antiquity. But when it comes to the Golden Age, yeah, they were generally elected.
Yeah, there may be some exception. There's one difference between the late 17th, early 18th century. Where it could be the same, but I haven't found any early 18th century documentation of this. But late 17th century, the general tradition was if buccaneers went to sea, they captured a better ship. That ship was actually given to the captain, and then he got a certain number of shares for it. Okay, so this is how captains late 17th century could actually get really rich. If you had 12 shares for the vessel and you had a very profitable cruise, you probably only needed a couple of those shares to do maintenance on the vessel and take care of it, and the rest of it went into his pocket. And in a moment, I'll remember why I had that. Oh, yeah, the point I'm trying to come to is that often the captains with reputations and already had their ships, it might be a condition of signing on with them is that they were the captain. That does not mean that they couldn't be removed from command, however. So, and like Lawrence says, though, basically, yeah, you were elected in the Golden Age and served at the pleasure of the crew. And they could depose you. That also caused problems at times. There's some notoriously screwed up cruises because of political factions, you know.
Mutiny.
A lot of it depended on
mutiny.
They called it mutiny. Technically, it was democracy. But
okay. Fostering Atheism asked, who do you consider the most infamous pirate and why? And if you each just pick one, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, it kind of depends on how you're using infamous, because I know when it comes to the biggest fleet, like the most successful and in a sense of sheer power, the most terrifying, I think it would be mm-hmm. Cheng Yi Cao. But when it comes to how fucked up someone is, I would say it was probably Francois Lolonais. That guy was seriously messed up.
All right.
Francois, a badass pirate named Francois? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a French pirate.
His real name was Jean David now, but most of these buccaneers late 17th century had nom de guerre. They had, you know, they took different names for a lot of reasons. I don't know why he would take Francois, but French, I don't know.
What would be yours, Mr. Little?
And again, it depends on what you're defining here. If you're meaning, you know, are we looking at notorious,
scary,
infamous,
badass.
Scary badass.
I mean, if I would probably not Blackbeard, because we really don't have as much information as we'd like to think we were. Plus, he got his, in actual hand-to-hand combat, he and about 11 of his guys got their asses totally kicked by 13 Royal Navy seamen. I mean, it was literally...
But he hung candles from his beard.
And probably burned his beard off doing that, too, for all we know. I mean, it's not something I'd try. I mean, you ever watch a kid get their hair in a birthday candle? But
like Michael Jackson in a Pepsi commercial.
Yeah, like so that.
Really, I mean, yeah, if you're looking for really, really, you just mean like a stereotypical mean killer type.
Yeah.
You could almost pick anybody out of Alexander X. Melling's book on Buccaneers who were doing it. Like Lawrence says, Lolanois might be one of the, it's probably right up there at the top of just both being very successful, but also just being a very nasty human being. My favorite, though, if you of famous pirates would probably be Lawrence de Graaf, a Dutchman who had served the Spanish as a gunner. Got captured, went over to the French, became one of the most famous late 17th century filibusters of all time. Very, very successful, very swashbuckling, dashing, big Spanish, you know, handlebar mustache. Reputedly had, when he was in town and Saint-Domingue in one of the ports there, he'd have violins and, you know, a whole posse following him around. You know, very, very successful guy. He actually fought, defeated a member of the Spanish, a ship of the Spanish Armada de Barlovento with a very rich cargo. He fought two ships of the Spanish, this armada was a pirate hunting armada, basically. He fought two ships, each of which was about twice his size, to a standstill and escape from them. You know, just he's a true swashbuckling kind of guy. Probably a cad, to use an old word term, too. He was married to a woman in the Canary Islands. He met a rich widow on Saint-Domingue, married her instead, you know, became a French, legitimate French officer, and actually got a divorce from that poor woman in the Canary Islands. And there were rumors that he was also married, probably illegally, because he never divorced his first wife in Veracruz prior to that, not a child by it. But anyway, if you're looking for just a great swashbuckling character, it would probably be Lawrence de Graaf. You don't hear as much about him because he was with the French, and most of the accounts of him are in French. You can look him up on the internet. There's some pretty good stuff on him out there, and some incorrect things as well. But
you know, okay. I said Jack Sparrow about it being in French. Mm. Before we talk about Jack Sparrow, hopping off the note about it be most of the stuff being in French, I find the same problem when I was looking into Chinese pirates, because most of it has not been translated, and I do not understand Chinese, so there's not really much for me to go off of.
And this just have chopsticks as instead of a hook.
Okay, next question. Did pirates ever resort to cannibalism, and if so, what was the punishment?
I mean, I can think sometimes of... they would, but not like with each other, I don't think.
Well, that's semen that anywhere. Yeah, if you're lost at sea, you might resort to it, but it's not a pirate thing specifically. There were not pirates offhand. I can really think of only one account, and that's they weren't technically pirates. That was Juan Corso, who was probably Juan Miguel, actually, a Cuban privateer in the late 17th century. The English considered him a pirate because a lot of things he did, he probably were outside the bounds of his commission, but... he and a guy named Pedro de Castro were sent to hunt for La Salle's, you know, the famous La Salle who explored the Mississippi and all that. He built a small colony. It was in Texas, but they were looking along the Gulf Coast for it, and they got shipwrecked. And the survivor account said that between Native American attacks and their general starvation that they ate their dead. I don't know if they killed their dead, killed people to eat them, but they basically ate them down to their heads, I believe was the quote. But it's not a pirate thing. It's like Lawrence was saying, it's just, you know,
survival.
Extreme circumstances and survival of, you know.
Okay.
I know there's a fascination with cannibalism, but.
I don't know. What were pieces of eight?
Big cat. You can take that, Lawrence, or I can.
To my understanding, they were just relatively the same size pieces of, I think they were either gold or silver. And I know that two pieces of eight was one doubloon. That's what I remember.
Yeah, two gold coins would be a doubloon. The piece, it's basically a, in Spanish, it's the peso de ocho reales, or it's a peso of eight royals. It's all the classic irregularly shaped silver coins. It was common currency in the New World. It was actually common currency around the world. They're cool looking coins. Legitimate thing. That's what pretty much passed for money in most of the European colonies in the New World. They didn't use local currencies. It was Spanish money. Piece of eight. It's a cool coin.
Okay.
You can find plenty of them for sale from legitimate dealers on eBay.
Cool.
They'll advertise them as pirate money.
Oh, okay. So what was the age range of a typical crew?
Mostly I'd say late teens, mid-20s.
Yeah, so that's what I've seen. They were older, and when it comes to statistical outliers, I want to tell the story of John King. He was this, I forget the name of the ship he was on, but Bellamy attacked the ship he was on, and he was on it with his mother. And he saw these pirates raiding. He was like, wow, I want to be a pirate. This looks so cool. And he apparently threatened to kill himself if he couldn't be a pirate. And then his mom, you know, begrudgingly had to let him go be a pirate. So he was legitimately part of, this 9-year-old kid was legitimately part of Bellamy's crew for, I think, a little over half a year until the Witta crashed. And he died in that crash.
I don't understand. Yeah, there's some accounts. Society terrifies me.
Yeah, there's a few ships boys I know that a guy named Taylor was reportedly one of a pirate, late 17th century pirate named Bannister. He was hunted down, captured by the English Navy eventually, and the captain had orders to hang them, Bannister and any of his men that he captured. And so they hung them all inside of Port Royalis. They came into harbor, but they hung up one, maybe two boys, and one of them reportedly became a pirate named Taylor. Yeah, they just hung them up by their waists from the yard arms. They weren't going to hang boys, but you do find some boys among the crews. That was common maritime crews anyways, instead of ship's boys. The oldest I've seen legitimate, I think, was probably an 80-year-old man named Swan. He was a buccaneer, 1670s, 1680s. He got killed on the Isthmus of Darien. He couldn't keep up, and Spaniards surrounded him, and he wouldn't surrender, so rather than engage this 80-year-old man in hand-to-hand combat, they just shot him down. That said, I know some 80-year-olds who kick your ass, too, so it might have been a smart thing to do.
Yeah, that's a badass way to go, though. You know, that's at the age where I have a theory that there's a certain age you can get where you can get away with doing anything. Like, it doesn't matter what you do, or, you know, you can go out in public and call scenes, and if you're a certain age, it's just, oh, well, he's just an old age. So if I got to the point where I was in that age, I could go out on a pirate. That's the one time in my life I could be a pirate. I could not be a pirate in my 20s or 30s. I would not survive a day. But I feel like going out at like 90 as a pirate, wheel me down that plank.
Okay, so there's one more question before in the comments before we get to Super Chats. What is your biggest problem with Pirates of the Caribbean series? And that's from Gage.
It's all of it.
All of it?
All of it. I didn't like them.
Oh.
All right. For me, the first one's enjoyable. It was like the first Star Wars. I saw it. I was a senior in high school. I just graduated maybe when Star Wars came out. It was fun. It's an enjoyable diversion. Don't take it seriously. And the rest of them after that pretty much sucked. And I know I'm going to get hear from haters about that now. But
I also only liked the first one.
I wouldn't take it seriously.
The first one was really good, and they just kind of went downhill from there. Although I think the apex of the rest of the movies was that fight scene at the end of the third movie with Jack and Davy Jones, like when they're on top of the masts. I think that was a pretty awesome scene.
I just love Johnny Depp as the pirate. Like, I love Johnny Depp as Jack Sparrow. Like, the rest of everything else, like, I just wish, like, he could just do that. Like, I would watch him on YouTube do that all the time.
The character, you know, but when I see him, and I know he did a wonderful job playing the role, but when I see him and then I think about these old SEAL Team Master Chiefs, these guys with 10, you know, or 20, 30 years of service, these old Vietnam, crusty old veterans who've seen, you know, things that I would never even have been able to see. And they remind me of these old Buccaneers I read. They would kick Jack Sparrow's ass in half a second if they even bothered to give him a second glance. You know,
but he would come back. He's dead.
Yeah, I know. He's... It's spit out by you know.
So is Dave doing super chats?
He's going to do that. But if I was Johnny Depp, I agree with Casey wholeheartedly. I would be Jack Sparrow. I would just transform into Jack Sparrow. And the only person that could get away with that, like where people would just be around him and not think twice about it, would be Johnny Depp. He's the one person that could actually transform into a pirate for the rest of his life and identify as a pirate. Mm-hmm. And nobody would question that. They'd be like, oh, well, that's just Johnny being Johnny.
Dude, Johnny Depp could do anything. Everybody. He could transform into Edward Scissorhands and be Edward Scissorhands for the rest of his life, and it would be fine. Like, nobody gives a fuck. He could be Willy Wonka forever. Yep. Like, he's Johnny Depp. He can legit do anything.
He could be the Mad Hatter
Edward Scissorhands
forever.
Would get messy.
Go ahead, Dave. Real.
Well, I got one more question that I think Casey missed because it wasn't tagged to her. It's from Ganesh Chandrasekaran. I forget how to say his last name.
Ganesh. What's up, Ganesh?
Ganesh, our friend. How was piracy different in different sea routes, i.e. the Atlantic versus Indian Ocean versus the Strait of Malacca? How much did they influence one another?
Yeah, was there like an East Coast Pirates and a West Coast Pirates? Did they have beef like Biggie and Tupac?
Like gangs of pirates.
You're getting into a whole...
Captain Hook, who shot you?
Lawrence's,
who shot you?
You're getting into Lawrence's half a million word. 200 episode YouTube series here. I mean, if you just go into India and piracy and privateering in there, I mean, that's a subject that you could write volumes and volumes on, and there actually have been volumes on. It varies from culture to epoch to. I mean, that's a really good question, but that's a.
It's a can of worms question.
It's cold.
So
yeah, that's the
only thing that really comes to mind for me is during antiquity they would generally stay along the coast because that was how they didn't get lost. That was the best way to do that. So pirates would, you know, be on like some island somewhere, but then they would patrol the coast that they knew. Shipping ships would merchant ships would be going along, and it was generally near the coast, so that was kind of their prime location, at least in the Mediterranean. But when it comes to piracy outside of that, I mean, they all had, you know, various routes. Depending on, you know, where you want it, like Benerson said, depending on where you want to go and the era, all that stuff.
Yeah, it's a fascinating subject, just looking at the history of piracy. If you can tie it into world history, and you can go into any culture you want. Basically, if it was a maritime culture, there were pirates involved, and I mean, it's a good excuse to, and it's a good way to study history from. At least it's not as dry as looking at history conventionally.
Yeah. Dave is getting ready to read the super chats, and before we do, Casey, I'm just gotta say I'm a little offended that you didn't ask me who I consider to be the most notorious pirate.
Oh well, I mean, it wasn't my question; it was somebody else's question. So, Kyle, who do you think the most notorious pirate is?
Napster, duh.
LimeWire.
Close second.
Bear share.
Go ahead, Dave.
Okay, super chats from Damage Dolly, $2. Welcome back. Thank you very much, Damage Dolly. From Jimmy Sislow, Jimmy Sizzlo for $19.99. Why? Because a penny counts, I guess. When asked why the pirate keeps getting his ship steering wheel stuck in his pants, he said, "It drives me nuts. Glad to have you guys back."
Nice, Jammy. Thank you.
I've heard
it's
better.
Good to be back. We've missed you.
It's Jammy. You got to go. He's always got to be joking. $2 from Steve McRae. Stormseeker with Patty Gertie. Pirate metal.
Who's I knew Steve that was going to happen. I knew it.
Who's Steve McRae?
I knew he was going to bring up the pirate metal. I can feel it.
Patty Gertie? Is that what he said? I didn't get that.
Yeah, Stormseeker. The song Stormseeker with Patty Gertie. He said it's pirate metal, basically.
Oh, okay. I'll have to look. There are very few pirate metal bands, at least. There's Hailstorm, and I guess you could count Flogging Molly, maybe. And
Lawrence,
then,
if you want to bond with somebody over pirate metal, like I said, I didn't even know that was really a thing. But if there's somebody that you want to bond with over pirate metal, Steve McRae is the one to talk to. He is huge pirate metal fan.
Good stuff.
Are you fucking with
me?
Like, are you fucking with them?
No.
Are you serious?
I'm not. I'm serious. Yeah. Steve is really big into pirate metal. He's actually the person that introduced it to me. I didn't know it was a thing until Steve showed me that video.
I didn't know it was a thing until tonight.
Yeah, I didn't.
Know. Yeah, I haven't considered Flogging Molly as pirate metal, but I guess it works. I introduced my younger grown-up daughter years ago to Flogging Molly. It's all their concerts now, whenever she can.
Yeah, I do the same thing with Hailstorm. Hailstorm is just so amazing to me.
All right, so
okay, any more super chats?
We got three more. We got 0132132 for $6.66 as usual. I missed you, glorious bastards. Glad the show is back. I plan to continue wasting a lot of time here. Wink.
We missed you as well, sir.
Yes. S106I Dan. I don't even know how to say that. What the heck does that mean? But anyway, $10. So happy to see that my favorite, quote, discount Garden Gnome live feed, end quote, is back up and streaming. I also enjoyed seeing the eye patch, Kyle. Good to have you guys back from a one-eyed compatriot.
Well, we had to bring up the old gnome, did we? That's okay.
Yes.
I'll find out.
Yes.
I found out some information about you. I'm coming.
And Uncle
Ned
for $2, Australian. Glad to
Uncle
have
Ned.
You all back. Yes, Uncle Ned.
Thank you, Uncle Ned. Uncle Ned will be back with us. We had to rearrange when he's going to pop in, but he'll be popping in for a smoking nun session. We were going to have him actually do last Friday, but we got banned, so that didn't happen. But now that we're back, we will get Uncle Ned back and his exuberant lights. So,
awesome.
Good deal. Okay, we're going to give you guys the last words. Actually, I'm going to give KC the last words. She can... I always do this to her, but I think it's funny, so I'm gonna keep doing it to her.
KC, he doesn't hate it. That's why he keeps doing it.
Give us your before we close out. Give us your words, the one phrase or quote that you would want all people to live by or to follow. Whatever your favorite quote is, we'll end on that. But Mr. Little and Lawrence, I'm going to let you guys take this opportunity to plug anything that you want, your channels. I know you got a book on the myths of the pirates that I heard about earlier. So take this time and let people know where they can find out more information about you and follow you on social media, all that kind of stuff. Lawrence, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. So my channel is Milwaukee Atheists. We do a lot of stuff, as you could probably tell from me being here. We do stuff on piracy. we mostly do stuff on like philosophy and the history of religion. A lot of in-depth dives into biblical scholarship because I think it's really interesting. I'm currently writing a book called Of Heathens and Heresy, about the effect of ancient religions on Christianity. And that's probably going to take me a long...
one of those, by the way.
All right, it's probably going to take me a long ass time to write. Okay, no problem. but obviously, you know, can find me on Twitter at MKE Atheists and Facebook Milwaukee Atheists. We also have a website with a forum, MilwaukeeAtheists.com. So if you're interested in this kind of stuff, definitely subscribe to the channel, and we keep people updated. We do a weekly show, Atheist Sunday School, where we just read through the Bible. We're in Judges right now. Got some steamy stuff in Judges. And we kind of, we read through it, we add our own.
I just, you know, got cold chills when you said that.
We add our own kind of funny commentary along with scholarship. So that's what we do. And I'll pass it off to Benerson.
You can just Google me, Benerson, Benerson's B-E-N-E-R-S-O-N. My father's name taken from a last name of Sandlot ball player, apparently, by my grandfather. But in any case, just Google me. Got a website up with the books. You can find them on Amazon. Got a blog on WordPress, too, which I just kind of go randomly back and forth between various swashbuckling subjects. Welcome to ask me questions via Facebook or email me, whatever you want. If you don't hear back immediately, please just ping me again. I get really busy around here, especially with a two-year-old and everything. So I'm not trying to avoid anybody. Just keep bugging me and I won't be offended, and I'll get back to you.
Excellent. Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Aren't you glad tomorrow is Talk Like a Pirate Day?
Huh? Couldn't be.
I'm glad tomorrow is Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Yeah, KC,
I don't have
will
a book
now
for it yet.
KC will now enlighten us with words to live by for a better life.
Well, my favorite short saying is stand up and use your voice. And I know that's the GE slogan thing, but that comes from a personal story for me. So I think it's important that everybody stand up and use your voice, because it's important, and it doesn't, nobody's voice is too small.
Very well said. And tomorrow, make sure that you stand up and use your pirate voice. And with that,
yes.
And with that, we and with that we say, go swab the deck, mateys. Yohoi. This has been Ideology.
Bye.
Non sequitur. Your facts are uncoordinated.